Welcome to the Sociological POV.
This podcast emerged from some fascinating discussions
in an introductory sociology course
at Lansing Community College,
where we attempt to gain insight
into other people's perspectives,
the good,
the bad,
and the world around us.
We hope to mirror that concept with this podcast
as we welcome a range of voices from diverse backgrounds
to share their thoughts on a current event
or topic that matters.
So with that said,
let's get into it
and start gaining perspective.
Hi there. Today we have
Jafret,
Eric,
and
Kira.
And this is Eliza Robison here at LCC, Lansing Community College. Today we're going to talk about the value of education today. So I hope you're going to enjoy this topic. I hope this is something that relates to you. And our first question of the day is, what do you think about our education system today? Eric, you want to go for that one?
Yeah, I think education today is just, it's more a matter of money, not just to get the education, but also to a goal you need to reach with education instead of just getting knowledge and information, which is basically what is education. Mm-hmm. And you know, yeah, no more stuff, blah, blah, blah. But now it's just a matter of money.
What about you, Kira?
Yeah, I definitely think it has become a for-profit business, and it's also become less of an optional thing, especially in the job market today. I think a lot of kids don't feel like they have as much of a choice for a degree, for an option, or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think that it's easy to kind of tell your children to go and get your education and do this, but not help them with accessing that or, you know, navigating it. And also, that process is a little bit confusing for many just fresh out of high school, because that's usually the people who go into higher education. And I also think that it is very expensive. Not to say that, you know, community college is better or worse or anything like that, but I think that for what you're getting, it's too much.
Hmm. Okay. And it sounds like you were saying almost there's no educational literacy. Like, we don't get financial literacy as young people in the society. It's almost like we're not getting that explanation. Okay, interesting. What do you guys think about how education is valued today? And then what patterns in our culture right now indicate that it's valued at this level? Is it valued high? Is it valued low? What tells us that?
I think about it in like two separate contexts. So like within, like I was saying, the job market, it's very valued. Like a degree is better than no degree, even if you have experience in that, like that job or anything. Like they'll be more likely to hire someone with a degree about something random or not about that. But also I think a family context or just like a population context, a lot of people are thinking it's not worth it for what you're getting, like Jafret was saying. It's just too expensive. There's other options. Like, you can make it work in the sense. Mm. I don't know. I don't really see many other options except for, like, trades or any thing, but I don't want to personally go into trades, so I find my only other option is college, and that's why I'm at community college, because it's free for me. So that's the options I got.
Okay.
I have.
Any thoughts to add on that?
I think it is value, either in a good or in a bad way, because in a good way, you have the knowledge to educate other people, right? But in a bad way, how would I say it? I don't know how to translate it, but it is like people might feel superior than others.
Yeah. Credentialism.
Credentialism.
Yeah.
And like, there is this idea of you have to go to college. And not just any college, you have to do to some specific one. But again, we return to the topic of money, where they are, because they're expensive. But what about those who do not go? They are in a different, like in a lower stratus of the society, right? Even though there is just a difference of knowledge.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for people to get access to education as is, but also the companies that are hiring people require degrees. They require like this and this and this, and it's no more, no less. And especially now that AI is kind of delegating those applications to the bin, or, oh, this is a potential candidate, or this. You know, there's less of a human interaction with that, but they require it, and also the access is very hard. Like, it's low accessibility, but it's in demand.
Hmm. Okay. Do you think that this has changed over time? Do you think that education has, I mean, you guys are talking about this in two separate things. In the job market, it's very valued, but outside of the job market, it's not valued. Do you think that this change has been happening over time, and what might be decreasing the value in the general population?
I think that it is valued 100%. In my opinion, socially and in the workforce, it's valued because it's like, oh, look, my son went here, or, oh, I went here, you know, and people are like, wow, they did this and they went on to do this. But I think that the point that I was trying to make is that it was easier to go into education like 50 years before. And it was like a nickel and a tissue, you know, the cost. But now it was easier to access back then. And now it's just like, oh my gosh, I'm going to go into this much debt for this. And I don't even know if I'm going to get a job.
Gotcha. What about connecting that with not just college, but before that? So secondary and primary education. Are those two segments of our educational experience preparing us for college, or is that part of this kind of big leap? You're talking mainly about the financial investment. Our early education, is that not preparing us for college well enough?
Well, so thinking about the application process, because, I like what Jafret was bringing up, like, the application process has become so crazy. Like, my great aunt, who went to college in like the late 70s, early 80s, she only applied to U of M for her undergrad, got in, went to U of M, and then only applied to Wayne State Law School, got in, went there. So she wasn't even thinking about any other schools. She knew she could get in, but even like from birth, from parents picking their school district that their kids go into, I think that plays a part into their college. But also the tests we have, the SATs, there's also the ACTs, but my school or my district did not do that. But even in middle school, in my language arts class, we had PSAT Fridays. So since tween age, I had been practicing how to take this test that I would take in 5-6 years that would determine my college acceptance. Mm-hmm. So I just think it's kind of crazy we do that from such a young age. It's more, sometimes it feels like K through 12 was focused on how to take tests and how to get into college than more than just the knowledge of learning.
Hmm. And it sounds like, and I think there's data to back this up, there's more people going, so there's going to be more competition, so they have to make the stakes higher. Mm-hmm. And that's good that more people are going, but then how do you maintain the value of a college degree? You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. That's tricky, because we want more people to go, but are they prepared to go? Yeah, what do you think, Eric? You think this is something outside of the education system is causing this change?
I think the education system is changed in base of the working market.
Okay.
As he said, socially, education will be always valued. It doesn't matter the time, I guess, I think. Mm-hmm. But when we talk about working, the job market, it is always changing. Like, before COVID, it was different, and I guess 10 years before that, it was totally different too. So, and the education system will change based on the job market. So,
do you guys think it's changing fast enough? I mean, with everything with AI, that's a huge change. But also think about how there's such a need in the trades right now, but we're not getting people in the trades. So it's almost like we have too many people going one direction and not enough people going in other directions.
Yeah, like everyone wants to a degree. Uh-huh. Like, that's the main goal for everyone, literally everyone in we don't have enough, what is it called, workforce?
Sure, yeah. For certain jobs.
For certain jobs.
Yeah, I know for my brother-in-law works for the Carpenters Union as their political director. And a couple years ago, they put $1 million into like a trailer that they can haul around to different schools and different events that like you can walk through and kind of learn what it means to be a carpenter or a millwright and like the benefits that they get because they get paid during your apprenticeship. There's so many benefits to becoming a tradesperson to try to draw people in, but still they're not getting as enough people, as many people.
And it's paid
as
well, too. Yeah.
They're paid very well. As soon as you're an apprentice, you start building your 401k and you get health benefits. And even some cases, they provide housing, free housing. Mm. There's just like so many opportunities. They were at the Ferndale Pride event a couple of years ago, and I met a trans carpenter who used the money they received to pay for their gender affirming care from like their apprenticeship with the carpenters. But it's still not a big enough draw for kids. They still see college as only the only option. Because for so long, we were told, go to college, go to college, go to college. And now it's like, well, now we need other to diversify as well.
You know, the talk about, I think here, it's more populated. So, and it's a college town. So, like, they're going to be like, oh, I want to go to this college and I want to go to this college. And that's mainly ingrained to you for sure. In like elementary school and high school. But in my experience, I come from a smaller town. It's bigger now, but when I was younger, like it was very, very rural. And so a lot of, like we had this thing called the Career Center where you would go and do things. I chose health science and there was like a million other options that you can go, but there was a lot of welders and then there was a lot of like electricians. And to me, that seemed predominantly what younger, mostly male kids were going and choosing to do. So it's funny that there are some places that are lacking of workforce, but like...
Because in the rural town I am from currently, I see that as well. That's more popular, there's more push for it than I imagine is happening in the urban college town.
Right.
So, and that's that, we were actually talking about this in class today, right? The rural and urban difference, we don't think about that as really a defining feature of someone's identity, but it does have a big impact on things outside of just your workforce, including political ideology. Yeah, I think that's a great point. The college town aspect is for sure. And then it's like, if you don't go to college, you know that the identity is not valued as much within the larger workforce. What do you think about students in school today and options finishing school? I know that you kind of already touched on that there's not a lot of options, but I'm thinking more like kids that are coming up through school right now. What do you think it's going to look like, especially with the role of AI, the changing expectations in the classroom, as you guys know. What do you guys think about that?
Not to be like a hater on younger generations, because it's not their fault, and I hate when that happens, but I just don't think they have enough educational responsibility on themselves, because so much of it is online. Even like, I'm 21, so I think I was like one of the first kids to have Google Classroom or like D2L or anything, where homework assignments started being due at midnight compared to like if you turned a homework assignment in person. So that already leads to kids staying up like later, or it just changes the way kids do school. And with so much of it being online now, it makes me very nervous. Like yesterday we had the Amazon service or whatever, the power outage, and D2L was down. Like, we couldn't do anything yesterday. So
I didn't know about that.
So it just makes me nervous how reliant we are on, and how that's going to change the need for memorization versus understanding. I think that's the point I was trying to get towards. It's mostly memorization right now, at least in high school. It's like coming to college, I really started to understand the need to understand my classes and how they all interconnect and that kind of situation.
Yeah, which could be a good and a bad thing, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that little, like the younger generation, I have two nieces and a nephew. They're very young. The oldest is 13. She just turned 13. But we're looking at them, I just think that there is still the want for education. You know, they're good students and they're very, although, yeah, they'll be rambunctious at times. Yeah. I think that they're going to be okay, because as you get older, all kids are annoying. Mm-hmm. All kids are, not saying that yeah. they are, but, you know, as you get older, you start to mature and you start to realize, hey, like, I need to do this, I need to do that. That's where the responsibility yes. kicks in.
Yeah.
That's mostly, I think my responsibility, like my sense of responsibility didn't kick until I was like 18.
Exactly.
So
yes.
I think that they'll be okay. And right now it might seem a little gray because of AI, but mm-hmm. I think that we will adapt. We as in younger children will adapt to it in yeah. their own way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, I think the same as we did. I mean, we didn't have AI when we were at middle school or high school, but we had internet, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was a new thing, or what, iPhones, the new
yeah,
ones,
yeah,
the
right.
new cell phones.
It's not much different.
So by that time, the education system couldn't handle all those things, and the education system now cannot handle AI, mm-hmm. so it's kind of the same thing.
Right, and as the technology advances to have access to AI, there's also going to be advancements in, like, mitigating the use of it, you know?
Right.
So, although I don't like AI at all, I just think that having a, what is it, pessimistic.
Oh, yeah.
I think that they'll be okay. Humans are going to be humans. And
okay. I think they'll, okay. yeah, specifically like Gen Alpha, I think they'll feel the need to take on AI and the consequences
right.
and the both the benefits and the consequences of AI, just in the sense of like Gen Z and millennials taking on the responsibility of climate change and like the environment. I think each generation has one of those things, and that will be Gen Alpha's is AI and its like relationship in education.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that AI and everything before that has been changing expectations? You mentioned responsibility, but the expectations of what a person in the society is supposed to do. I would say, for example, what I see students struggle with is turning things in on time, communicating with a teacher when they have problems with something. And I feel like those expectations in the past would have been like, of course, I have to do that. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing that someone, you know, an individual, oh, you're bad because you can't do this. I just don't think it's being taught. I think those expectations have changed. And I suppose you could say that AI can handle all that, right? I mean, maybe that's what it is we're just, our culture is just going to allow AI to take over those responsibilities.
Yeah, I think in the sense, I don't mind AI for the menial tasks or like your bibliography or like the sense of like that where like, yeah, you should know how to do it, but you can help use AI. I mean, I use generators for my citations and everything. I think it just comes to the critical thinking points, because in my high school, every class I went to every day, there was somewhere on like the chalkboard or the whiteboard of like the learning statements of, and there was always some form of critical thinking within that. And so I think once we start using AI for the critical thinking, or being asked to use AI for the critical thinking questions, is when we reach a place. Is that where you were getting at? Of like teaching the responsibility?
Yeah, so you're saying AI could potentially take that over as well, and that would be a loss of responsibility for the individual
yeah,
person?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. Just like being able to use your brain muscles
yeah.
in the sense of juggling everything.
Right, but I mean, in the education system, that takes a lot of development.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I see that. I've taught at third, fifth, middle school, high school, college level. You have to be every step
yeah.
of the way. I imagine it's more than a question on the board to help people really access
yeah.
that ability. And I don't know, like you said, we're already focused on memorization. Can we in the future, with the way we're going, especially with kind of questioning of the value of going to college, can we still promote critical thinking and get people to see the value in that? Or is that something we just allow AI to take over?
I think it's happening.
Yeah.
Okay, we're already past that. Yeah. You guys are like, we're already there. Okay.
We're now dealing with the consequences of that, because okay. I think when there was a push to remove critical thinking from like things that are critical of blank, you know, legislation wise, I think that was initially when we started to go, you know, and then AI is just exasperating that problem even more, because there are people who are online using things that have been generated by AI, like, oh, well, this says this and this and this, and not doing their own research. So I think that's already an issue. But were you talking about the role of teachers in that sense?
True.
I think that nothing can replace the human contact that a teacher provides, and also nothing can substitute what the expectations for your teacher are. So like, if you have a question for a certain thing, AI is not gonna answer it how your teacher would like you to answer it, you know? So it's that thing that you have to go and you have to be like, hey, so this and this, how do you want me to do this? You know, and then they'll elaborate. Mm-hmm. But.
Okay. Okay. Well, do you think there could be anything that replaces what we have in the future if we do go in the direction of more reliance on AI? Is it possible? I mean, you mentioned something earlier about opportunities, and it made me think of how people become like YouTubers or gamers, right? I mean, but this is real. It may not be a common thing, but a lot of young children believe this is the direction they're going to take. Actually, let me add on to that. Could this have anything to do with exacerbating social inequality that we see? Access to AI or going to get a college degree, the options that are available to people, as that shifts, are we going to see increasing gap between the wealthy and the poor in this country?
I think that gap is already exacerbated as it is. And I think I know what you're referring to. Like, if they go into these professions and with the amount of money that they have, is that what you're talking about? Like,
kids are interested in that because of the money? Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah. But you have to take it. Like, if you ask a little kid, like, oh, what do you want to be when you grow up? And they're like, oh, I want to be like Kaisenet or like a streamer. That's okay, I'm not going to take that. Like, I'm going to take that with a grain of salt, because these little kids, their brains are not fully developed. My brain is not fully developed. My frontal lobe is not fully developed yet. So I just think that little kids are going to say odd things. And when they see things on YouTube, and when they see things on TikTok, and when they see things on any social media platform, I think that that's something that just sticks to them.
Yeah. So the grouping is happening online, and there's no social network or social connection and teacher to be outside of that. Yeah.
I think like being a YouTuber or like a kid wanting to be a YouTuber or something it's the same degree of like wanting to be a rock star or something when you grow up, but it's also much more obtainable. I mean, like, it's still hard, but you can start now and start posting videos to try to gain that kind of experience and stuff. But again, agreeing with Jeffrette, I think the use of the internet can make you feel like you aren't isolated when you really are from the actual world. So you think you're okay, and that just leads to the loneliness epidemic. Then you end up with everything else. So I think it is a problem for turning that into education. We want to focus on to education.
Well, that sounds like a great topic for another.
Yeah,
I was straying. The grouping. I really like it. So we got to wrap up, but I really appreciate you guys being here with us. I hope it was a good conversation for everybody listening, and I hope you have a good day. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Sociological POV.
Thank you for your time.
This podcast is featured as a part of LCC Connect,
a podcast network developed by Lansing Community College.
To listen to this episode on demand
or explore other LCC Connect podcasts,
visit lccconnect.com.
We hope you'll join us again
on the Sociological POV
as we explore
the good,
the bad,
and the world around us.
featuring the faculty, staff, students, and others that helped to make Lansing's premier college what it is today. LCC Connect, Mid-Michigan's connection to Lansing Community College. To find out more about our featured programs or to listen on demand, visit us at lccconnect.org.
LCC Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
Lansing Community College is proud to be a veteran-oriented campus. Through the Center for Veteran and Family Support, LCC provides resources, guidance, and a welcoming community for those who have served, are currently serving, or support someone who has. Student veterans will find resources such as computer labs, academic advising, and available counseling for personal support, along with veteran education benefit assistance and VA healthcare assistance through the VA Vital Program. To learn more about veteran support and resources at LCC, visit lcc.edu and search Veteran Services.
Hey there, this is Dedalian, and I want to invite you to join me for a show called Behind the Connection. It dives into what's happening behind the scenes here at LCC Connect. It also provides you early introductions to new podcasts, some of the Connect initiatives that we are putting forth, and of course, insights into the concept of building the voices, vibes, and vision of LCC Connect. Find out more about it at our website. It's lccconnect.org.
What is dedication?
My daughter started making necklaces. She makes what we call affirmation fashion. I tell her every day that your black is beautiful. Your black is beautiful. And if there's anything better than being beautiful, it's being smart. If there's anything better than being smart, it's being kind. And reaffirming that every day is our method of making sure her chin never drops. My dad wasn't around, and I remember riding a bike and falling off and cutting myself, and me never just wanting to get back on it. People ask, how your children learn how to ride a bike, and you didn't. I didn't teach them. I just created an environment where they taught themselves, and all I had to do was be there.
That's dedication. Visit fatherhood.gov to hear more. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
A 7-week job training opportunity is now enrolling, and many can participate tuition-free. Those who have graduated from high school within the last 5 years can attend the Electrical Control Technician Boot Camp at no cost, thanks to grants from the Michigan Department of Economic Development. Those interested in the Electrical Control Technician Boot Camp provided by the LCC Job Training Center can learn more at lcc.edu/JTC.
LCC.
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
This is Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, a podcast and radio program presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. Most any contemporary musical style can trace its roots back to the blues. Time Signatures explores the blues and its musical connections with captivating interviews, lively discussions, and news from the world of the blues.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up and down these Michigan roads, yeah.
And now, here he is, your host, Jim Irvin. Baby, I'm
home. Well, thank you so much, Parker, and welcome to Time Signatures. I'm your host, Jim Irvin. And our guest today is a Minnesota-born guitarist who is largely known as a folk troubadour in the truest sense. He has released 19 albums over the course of the past 20 years, according to Spotify, boasts nearly 68,000 followers and more than 131,000 monthly listeners. He's also known to play up to 275 dates a year, and his new effort, Little Son, is being touted as an ambitious and raw album that exemplifies the best of his sound, a blend of the blues and folk traditions he continues to carry with him, and the steadfast originality of a poet. But what caught my eyes and ears was a recent concert by Vanessa Collier, where she played a beautiful resonator guitar handcrafted in the state of Michigan by Mule Resophonic Guitars right here in Saginaw. As I checked their website recently, I stumbled upon a video of Charlie Parr playing one of these beautiful pieces of art, and I became an instant fan. Charlie, it's indeed a pleasure to have you, sir. Welcome to Time Signatures.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate being on the show.
Yes, sir. So as we begin this discussion, Charlie, I have to tell you that this podcast is all about the blues, and having had a fair listened to a fair chunk of your music over the last week or so in preparation for this interview, I can absolutely attest to the fact that there are definitely some blues flowing through those fingers. Talk about your earliest memories of music, would you please?
Sure. You know, music played in my house pretty much all the time when my dad was home. My dad was not a player. He was a laborer. He was a meat packer, but he listened to music all the time. When he came home, he had one of those old Magnavox, you know, console stereos from the 50s.
Oh, yeah.
Tubes and everything in it. And he would just take a stack of records, put them on the changer, you know, those old changers that hold five records. And in my earliest memories of music is just that it was always there. He didn't like TV. My mom didn't care for the television. They just played records all the time. And his record collection was pretty varied, and he didn't even know how he got half the records he had. He just had them. So I got to sing along with Mitch Miller all the way to Lightnin' Hopkins. The record that I gravitated towards when I was actually able to, you know, kind of understand hearing music, I think I was like seven or something like that. I could manipulate the record player. You know, the records that I went to listen to again were Mance Lipscomb, Lightnin' Hopkins, and a record by Albert King called Live Wire Blues Power. I thought that was the most intense record I'd ever heard in my life. And I just listened to those records, and down in the basement of my house when I was growing up is where my sister lived, and she's quite a bit older than I am. And she listened to the Grateful Dead and the Rolling Stones and the Beatles. And my dad had a couple of the records from the Harry Smith anthology. They didn't have the covers or anything, just the records. But I think it's Cumberland Blues. I'm not sure, but the Dead had covered it at one point. So I distinctly remember hearing two versions of the same song in the same house, in the same week, you know, and it was a great experience. I mean, I was very lucky to have grew up with that much music around me all the time.
Absolutely. And it's funny, you talk about Sing Along with Mitch Miller. If I could put my hands on him, I have a stack of vinyl over here. I actually have a shelf with some vinyl on it. And I have two of his albums that I used to listen to when I was a kid. When I was in the Big Brothers program, my big brother actually played those. And I'll bet you money that you probably know quite a few of those songs in those albums, don't you?
Of course. When I was a teenager and I started like finding my own sounds, I was a big fan of like The Clash and The Minutemen by the time I was a teenager. You know, my instinct was to go ahead and make fun of Mitch Miller. But man, those records were important, you know, and they came with music sheets. And if you wanted to, you could just have a sing-along. And my parents were both born in the 20s. And so no one would sit in front of the TV. They didn't have a TV when they were coming up. Mitch Miller was something that they remembered. We're all going to sing a song. Here's the words, you know, and put on the record. And they would all sing along. You know, that's good stuff. We don't get that now. Or at least, you know, it's harder to find. But I think records were important.
Well, I'll tell you, these albums also have the sing-along sheets in them, so I got the real deal. And that's something that I want to expose my kids to sometime when they come over. I'm just going to pop them on and play them for them and enjoy it, you know. But I wanted to ask you, Charlie, at what age did you decide that you would pursue a life as a musician?
I haven't really decided that yet. I'm only 57. I still haven't decided. No, I was obsessed with the guitar from that I was 8 when my parents managed to get me a guitar. You know, and like I said, my parents were Depression era people. Nobody in my family was educated. You know, my dad wasn't allowed to go to school because he was in a farming family. I never thought of it as an option for a career. And as a matter of fact, I didn't even write my own songs until my dad passed away, and I was so grief-stricken that I had to put that energy somewhere.
Wow.
I just played all the time. I always played. And if someone thought I was good and said, hey, come and play at our house or whatever, and I would do that because all I wanted to ever do was play the guitar. I dropped out of high school, not because I was, getting into trouble, but because I was sitting in my room playing the guitar and I couldn't bother to be moved to the high school to go to class. So I played all the time. And at one point, about 23 years ago, a friend of mine invited me to, and I gigged and worked, you know, that's what I did. I figured that'd be my life. I would gig and work and get along. At one point, about 23 years ago, I was in a band called the Black Eyed Snakes, and he said, come over to England and tour the British Isles with us. I had a great time, and I told my boss, I said, I'm going to go do this thing, and I'll be back. And he said, well, I'll put you a little hiatus. You know, you get about a month off, but you don't get paid. I said, that's all right. And I did that, and man, that lifestyle just clung to me. And on that tour, I arranged another tour of the United States. And so when I came home, I never did go back to work. I'm still
preparing.
It is.
And by the way, we're very close in age. I'm going to be 60 in April, so we're very, very close. But speaking of the life of a musician, you're about to kick off a nice little spate of dates. I assume that you're going to be adding some more dates to those currently on your website, correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's going to be dates added throughout the year. But this is going to be a light year. I'm doing about half the shows that I usually do this year. Last year was very heavy. I was, around 250 last year.
Wow. And
including a six-week European tour. And it was great. It was a great year. The shows were great, but my mother also passed away last year, so everything got really dark.
Sorry.
Oh, thank you. But things got dark and heavy, and this year is a year that I'm just going to reel back just a hair. I'm still going to play. I play every day, and I'm going to do some. I've got a book project that's almost ready to go to the printers, and I've got an instrumental guitar project that I'm going to be recording soon, so there'll be more dates to answer your question, but not as many as usual.
Okay. 19 albums, just over two decades. That's quite a feat, especially when you consider all the traveling about that you do and playing like you do. How do you balance the writing, the recording, and the touring like you have?
I haven't really found a good balance for it, really. But for me, recording isn't my priority. I like performing best, so if I'm going to prioritize, I'm probably going to prioritize towards live shows because that's what I like to do the best. And recording, if songs are there and they're ready, recording's relatively easy. I usually approach it like I do a show,
Sure.
Even the last record where we had higher production values than I think I've ever had in my life, I still kind of thought of it as like being a show. And it, I think we kind of grabbed that sound, that spontaneous live sound, which is what I'm after. Writing is the tough one. Writing is, if you're in that mindset and you're prepared to write, if it doesn't show up, your mindset means nothing, if there's no ideas there. And then on the other hand, if you're driving into Manhattan on a really busy afternoon and you're just slightly late for your gig, best song ideas just come out of nowhere. Whole van is, I can't do anything about it. So writing is tougher. It's a little bit more of a game of chance, but sure. I do a notebook with me, everywhere I go, and write down all the little snippets. And I've got this phone now has a voice memo feature, and I'll just turn that on in the van and start hollering at myself about these ideas so that I can try to capture them later. But I write whenever I can write.
Yeah, I've got a little portable handheld recorder. It's a Zoom H4N. Mm-hmm. Has the XY mics on it. Great for doing memos or recording, interviews on the fly or whatever. Now, I'd love to have the backstory on your Mule Resophonic, Charlie. How did you learn of the Mule Company? And how long ago did you get your first Mule?
Well, I was playing a show, and the guy that was doing support had one of the early ones. And resonator guitars have fascinated me since I was let's see, I was 12 years old, going on 13, when I checked out a copy of the Father of the Folk Blues Son House record from the library. And sure enough, there's a picture of Son House holding a resonator guitar. I'm like, what is that? I need that. I need to know about that. And became obsessed with the instruments. So I saw this guy with this guitar, and I'm like, well, that's not a National. What is that? And he showed me, let me play it. He even gave me Matt's email address. And I wrote to him, and I said, I played that guitar. It's fantastic. I don't, you know, you don't know me from Adam. I'm nobody, but just another guitar player. But just wanted to write and say, man, if I get some money, I want to buy a guitar. He became a dear friend almost immediately. He's an amazing person. I love him to death. He offered me a good deal on that first guitar, and I was so excited when I got it. It's, you know, it was a metal-bodied instrument with a trichome set up in it. It looks like on guitar, but it's a trichome, which, if you go back in history a little bit, there is a patent applied for from National with a guitar with three cones inside of a single-cone body, but they never made one. And I got so excited, I called Don Young from National and told him that, you know, there's a dude in Michigan making these guitars like that. And he was all excited too, because, you know, he was first and foremost a lover of guitars and music, not about the business as much, but he was going to call Matt and talk to him about guitars. And then, unfortunately, Don passed away close to that time. But I played that guitar a lot. Eventually, you know, I had some tax bills that had to be made, and ended up selling about half the things in my closet to make up my tax bills. And that went with it. And so I was without a mule for about a year. And I just nothing else sounds like it. It's the most interesting kind of, complex tone in an acoustic guitar that I've ever heard. So I got another one, and then eventually Matt and I started talking about specific things that I would like in a guitar, because I am kind of picky, you know, and I have been known to take stuff apart when I don't like it and see if I can change it. So he started building me guitars, and he would send them to me, and I would get to try them out, and we'd talk about it and, you know, make changes on it. And so eventually now what's happened is he's built a signature model with all these weird ideas. So my main guitar right now is also a trichome, but it's in a wooden body. This one's mahogany. It's got 9 strings instead of 6. So the A, D, and the G strings are octaved like on a 12 string. Big Joe Williams. Think Big Joe Williams, you know, and then you're close. So that's the guitar that I play now. And that's the guitar that he's got on his website that people can buy, either a 6-string version or a 9-string or a 12-string version of the thing. And it's been amazing working with Matt. Not only is he an incredible maker of guitars, he's a luthier, he's just a super intelligent, thoughtful person who's got some great ideas about stuff.
Well, and I have to tell you, I also am a big fan of the resonator guitars. And it's funny you mentioned National, because I interviewed a gentleman by the name of Chris Tapp from a band, The Cold Stairs. And Chris was in London. I don't know if it was by happenstance or if he planned it this way, but it was during the Peter Green auction. Oh. And he ended up buying Peter Green's National resonator. And he is working on an album called The Green Album. You got to check out the songs that he's got up there, because it's so cool to hear Peter's guitar after all these years, you know, in somebody else's hands.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. Now, do you have just one of the mules, or have you got more added to the stable?
Right now I have two. I have my 9-string, and I've got the new 6-string version of the same guitar. You know, the ones that he's sent me over the years, you know, we've sent those back so he could kind of keep. We also have auctioned off a few of the guitars that he sent me for various things. And then recently, one of the metal-bodied ones that I had played for a long, long time, we gifted to a young blues player in Duluth that is going to put it to good use. So I've got I don't have many guitars in my closet right now. I've still got one National that I play a lot. I've got my two Mules. You know, I've got a couple of pretty beat up old 12 strings. Then I've got Spider John Kerner's 12 string, which is absolutely priceless and gets played almost every day. So,
wow. Well, Charlie, clearly your music resonates, and no pun intended, with your listeners and fans. I wanted to ask you about the COVID pandemic. How did that affect your trajectory and where you are today in relation to where you were back in early 2020?
Oh, gosh. Well, 2019 was a heavy year for me. I had 282 road shows in 2019.
Oh.
The 2020 was shaping up to be about the same again. We had a big, you know, big list of stuff. I was feeling a little bit burnt out. I had, you know, been going through divorce at the time, and, you know, just when the whole thing hit, I actually had nowhere to live because I had, separated from my wife, and so I ended up moving back into the house, which was nice, you know, because my kids were there, and I lived in the attic, you know, during the pandemic, and I sold records and guitars and eventually did these streaming concerts on the computers, you know, and that made me a little bit. And so I kept my nose above water. You know, I'm a really frugal person anyway. I don't, you know, if I don't buy guitars or records, I just, you know, give my kids my money and put the rest in the bank. And so sure. I was able to float through. And what I did was I wrote and practiced. You know, I practiced a lot, and I wrote an entire record. And then I had so much material that I wrote a book of stories based on the songs and the record that I wrote during the pandemic. So creatively, it felt fine. You know, I was very lucky because none of my family got sick. I didn't get sick. My mother, you know, was healthy during that time. It was a really rough time, you know, to kind of sit and be a spectator. But, I just kind of rolled through it. The thing that it did for me going forward was it made me not kind of want to play so many shows, because when I left my job, I treated the music thing as a job. So I took every gig, every one. That's how you end up doing 282 road shows a year. You just
yeah.
Comes along. The routing was crazy. I didn't care. You know, I'd drive all night. And I did, and it's unhealthy. You know, I slept in the car all the time. And if I had tours with other bands that were doing tour buses so they could drive at night and sleep, I'm still chasing that bus and sleeping in rest areas and parking lots, you know, and just doing my best and getting tired. So then after the pandemic, I kind of didn't want to do that anymore. So I found a place to live in St. Paul and kind of settled in. And, you know, I do shorter tours now. I do 10 days, 14 days, and then I just stop. And instead of doing months out at a time, or sure. Consider permanently itinerant, you know, living in a minivan. I don't feel like doing that.
So how has the pandemic affected the attendance at your concerts? Are you finding that folks are finally coming around again, or are they still kind of edgy about coming out?
I have found that the tickets and audiences and stuff like that are steady, and that it's good. You know, initially after the pandemic, of course, it was a little tougher, but I play small rooms. I play small rooms in theaters. And when I first started back, you know, we were deliberately keeping a cap on the audience size so that the people wouldn't be uncomfortable having to sit close to one another.
Sure.
And that felt good, and it felt right. And now I'm still playing the same venues. It's just this, people are back again, and it's fine. I don't like playing big venues. It's hard. It takes a different kind of energy than I have. If I'm in a room of 50 to 200, 300 people, that feels really good to me. I feel like I've everyone had a nice night. I've opened for bands that draw 8,000, 10,000 people, and I don't know what to do with that. I feel like a peanut. You know, and I'm just like, I don't even know where these folks are in the room anymore. It's confusing. It's like going to sleep in a bed that's far too big. And when you wake up in the middle of the night, because you have to go pee, you can't find the edge of the bed, and it's really dark. that's what playing in a giant venue feels like to me.
Okay. But
then the people are back, and it's been great. The tours last year were all fantastic.
Great, great. Well, I have to tell you, Charlie, I love the mix that you present in your albums. I caught myself really enjoying the title track of your Little Son album. Most definitely has a Chicago blues-like feel to it, especially with the harp in there. Talk about your writing style for just a moment.
Well, normally I write kind of, I write kind of in story form. I write down, you know, stories that I want to tell. Little Son, for example, is about Tony Glover, the harmonica player from Kerner and Glover. I used to go down to the Times to see him play every Thursday. You know, so the song is kind of a story about, you know, going to see a musical hero play who's passed on and wishing he was still here. I write down kind of a long form story that wouldn't make any sense as a song, but you know, once a melody shows up, you can kind of attack the story with the melody in your mind like a scalpel and start peeling out lines that advance the story and serve the song at the same time. You know, and that's the way I've always kind of gone about it. But, you know, my songwriting wise, I'm really influenced by, you know, songwriters from the 20s and 30s, you know. Booker White, for example, I think is a brilliant songwriter. His songs, you know, have like an arc to them, you know, especially the Sky songs, which are, you know, definitely made up on the spot. Even those have this like arc to them, you know, they're beautiful songs. You know, Frank Hutcheson's songs about, you know, Stag Lee and Titanic, you know, he was putting together a narrative. He was telling you the news, you know. Rabbit Brown, Henry Thomas, you know, all those guys, they were so heavily influenced by folk stories, you know, from the oral tradition. It came through in their songwriting, and they were as much storytellers as they were, you know, songsmiths. So I'm influenced by that. That's the way I want to write songs. So that's what I'm working on.
Very good. Well, as we wrap up this episode, where can people find more information on Charlie Parr? Maybe buy some albums. If you've got vinyl, buy some of that, some merchandise, check out your tour dates, or even book you for a gig.
Sure. Well, there's a website. It's just charlieparr.com. And I can't operate a website, but Mark, my buddy Mark, he put it together. So everything should be on there that needs to be on there as far as like gigs. And I think the record stuff, I think there's a link that'll take you to Smithsonian Folkways to buy records, but the only records that are available in physical form are the two on Smithsonian. Everything else is long gone, except if you want to stream music. You can get anything I've ever done on the Bandcamp, iTunes, Spotify worlds.
Okay, so can they buy digital versions of those albums?
Yeah, digital versions are all still available. You know, after the records are just expensive to repress and you know, it's tight. So I just sell the new ones.
Yes, sir. Well, Charlie Parr, it has indeed been a pleasure. I wish you continued success. And if you ever need a microphone to promote a tour or an album, you're always welcome here, sir.
Thank you very much. And thanks for having me on.
Well, it is indeed a pleasure to have you. And before we wrap this up, I just want to talk about, and it's kind of cool because we talked about streaming just a moment ago, and I like to educate our listeners and our viewers. People don't realize that it takes about 5,000 streams to equal the value of one purchase of an album. So what I like to do is recommend to people, buy the CD, buy the vinyl. If you get a chance, buy some merchandise from these folks, because they're out there doing live music for us. And if we don't support them, we're going to lose that live music opportunity. And I just would hate to see that. So for those that are watching and listening, please go buy a download, you know, go buy an album that Charlie has out there, a couple of the albums, the older ones, or all of them, you know. You'll be doing everybody a favor by doing so. Well, that wraps up this edition of Time Signatures. Once again, my thanks to our guest, Charlie Parr, but also to you, for without you, none of this would be possible. Jim Irvin reminding you that keeping the blues alive is everyone's responsibility, but preserving the history of the blues one story at a time, that's my mission. Until next time, so long, everybody.
This has been Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. For more information on cabs, visit capitalareablues.org. You can find this episode and past episodes at lccconnect.org. The Time Signatures theme song, Michigan Roads, is used by permission and was written by Root Doctor, featuring Freddie Cunningham.
You know I'm blind, blind, baby, driving up in
Until next time, keep on keeping the blues alive.
Examining the issues and topics that affect our lives from the local level to the world stage. Listen to the programs of LCC Connect anytime at lccconnect.org.
LCC
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
K-12 Operations at Lansing Community College has been a proud collaborator of the Lansing Promise Scholarship since 2012. The Lansing Promise Scholarship offers graduating high school seniors who live within the Lansing School District and attend a high school within district boundaries an opportunity to attend LCC. Since its inception, over 1,000 enrolled students have saved over $2 million, earning over 400 degrees and certificates, as well as 30,000 credits at LCC. For more information on the Lansing Promise Scholarship, please visit lcc.edu/hope.
Feeling froggy? Well, leap into 20-plus podcasts at lccconnect.org.
LCC Alumni Stories, a show dedicated to highlighting the amazing alumni of Lansing Community College. I'm Steve Robinson, president of LCC, and on each episode, I have the awesome privilege of getting to know one of our many inspiring alums and hearing about their experiences at and since leaving LCC.
Listen to this program and many others on demand at lccconnect.org.
Attention men under the age of 35. You know what really impresses the ladies? When a guy has a few drinks and later gets pulled over for buzz driving. That could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. There goes let's grab dinner and a movie. Oh, I know. You drive more carefully when you're buzzed. You've proven that hundreds of times. A woman admires that kind of confidence. And you've practiced how to speak if a cop does pull you over. Slowly, clearly, and politely, like, "Good evening, officer." A woman admires that kind of foresight. And what woman doesn't find it adorable that you call it buzzed even though the law calls it drunk? You could kiss $10,000 goodbye, along with any chance of having a girlfriend. Because nothing says, "I'm a catch," more than a guy who lives in his parents' basement and calls it my place.
Buzzed, busted, and broke. Because buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
The Adult Enrichment Program offers community members the opportunity to discover the art and skill of creative welding and metalwork. Those who are brand new to welding or have years of experience can create their own projects. From sculptures and wall art to functional metal pieces, this class, taught by LCC welding faculty, is open to all skill levels. Visit lcc.edu/keeplearning for more information.
This has been a presentation of LCC Connect, a weekly program that features the voices, vibes, and vision of Lansing Community College. All shows featured on LCC Connect are recorded at the WLNZ studio, located on LCC's downtown campus. Each program is podcast-based and can be heard anytime at lccconnect.org. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on one of our shows, connect with us by emailing lcc-connect@lcc.edu.